Before we get started with this episode, I want to tell you about something new from one of the oldest sponsors of our show, Sudio. They make headphones, some of which I'm wearing right now, and earphones. And those include the brand new Neo earphones with dynamic bass, two air vents to relieve ear pressure, detachable wingtips to fit any kind of ear, which is a problem for me with the points and everything, and 20 hours of play with the charging case. They also have a dual microphone technology that lets you sound clear on calls and, in this day and age, very important, in every Zoom meeting. The best part is they're only $89, and our listeners get 15% off with the promo code HAUNTED15. You also get a free Sudio tote bag designed by Icelandic artist Andrea Mack. Don't miss out on this great product and a great deal. Just go to Sudio, Sudio.com, and be sure to use the promo code HAUNTED15 at checkout. And now, on with the show. Welcome to the new episode of American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to the latest episode in our season on Haunted Hollywood, which is, as always, hosted and produced by Cody Beck and written and performed by Troy Taylor. That's me. It may seem like we've been wandering around the mean streets and dark back alleys of Hollywood for a long time now, but we still have some places to visit before the season comes to an end. There are stories to hear, hearts to break, murders to solve, and dreams to get stomped on, dented, and broken before we're through. If you've missed out on any of the shows this season, or if this is your first time tuning in, you'll want to go back to episode 70 of the podcast, which will get you caught up on all the murder and mayhem that's already happened in Hollywood already. Just keep in mind the episodes in the season are definitely not suitable for all listeners. So if you continue on from here, you can't say we didn't warn you. Well, if you're still here and didn't churn off the show in terror, let me tell you that the story that follows is considered to be one of Hollywood's original showbiz crimes, and it's one that's never been solved. It's filled with shady characters, starlets, child stars, and a movie director with secrets to hide. So sit back, relax, pour yourself a strong one, and get ready to meet the latest dead guy in Haunted Hollywood. On February 1st, 1922, William Desmond Taylor was one of the most famous movie directors in early Hollywood, and he was murdered in his bungalow in the Westlake District of Los Angeles. At first, it was assumed he died of natural causes until someone discovered he'd been shot in the back by a .38 caliber revolver. Taylor's murder became one of the most sensational cases in Hollywood's history of crime, and one that's never been solved. The coroner's jury in a crowded inquest had no choice but to return an open verdict. They simply had no clue about who'd done it. Taylor was dead. There were a lot of suspects, but the cops and the prosecutors were as in the dark about what had happened as the readers of the daily newspapers. But mystery is a prime ingredient for all the juiciest rumors in Hollywood. There was an entire cast of killers blamed for his death. And depending on what story you heard in the studio commissary, the murderer might have been an actress who had killed him in a jealous rage, the mother of a child star who was angry that Taylor had deflowered her daughter, the husband of a woman Taylor had elevated to stardom on the proverbial casting couch, or even a butler with whom the director was supposedly having a homosexual affair. Well, Taylor himself was an enigma, as we'll soon see, which made the gossip spread even further. As the police began investigating his death, they began discovering the director's closely kept secrets, which would link him to two of Hollywood's best-known sweetheart screen stars of the era. But who killed him? Was it a man or a woman, a jealous rival or a spurned lover? Was it a planned murder or a robbery gone wrong? Well, it's been a century since Taylor's death, and the questions remain unanswered, mostly thanks to executives at Paramount Studios, where Taylor and at least one of the suspects worked, and their tampering with the crime scene evidence. Studio head Adolph Zucker had his hand in the entire police investigation, and rumor has it that he made sure that a lot of things slipped through the cracks, so to speak. Paramount could hardly be blamed for attempting some damage control. The studios had a lot riding on their famous directors and actors, and there had already been a number of scandals that had rocked Hollywood before Taylor's death that had threatened to upset audiences across the country, especially in the more conservative Midwest and South. To counter the sordid reputation that had befallen the industry, Hollywood, led by Zucker, had hired U.S. Postmaster General Will Hayes to introduce the production code, which would censor Hollywood products and publicly keep the morality of the industry in check. Now, with the Taylor case getting mixed up in sex, drugs, and famous actresses, the country was stunned, horrified, and of course, fascinated by every lurid thing the police and reporters uncovered. Paramount was determined to keep a lid on the Taylor murder, even if it meant it would never be solved. But who, for our listeners, let's be honest, was William Desmond Taylor? Actually, that's for Cody. Taylor was born William Cunningham Dean Tanner on April 26, 1872, just south of Dublin in Ireland. He was the second of four children born to a British army officer and his Irish society wife. His father ran the household like a military barracks, and the father and son quarreled often. When William was 15 years old, he left home and went to England. By 1890, using the stage name Cunningham Dean, he began performing on the stage. When his father learned of the dishonor of having an actor in the family, he sent his son to America and enrolled him at Runnymede, a school in Kansas that turned disreputable and wealthy young men into respectable farmers. William was soon on his own in America, stuck in a university for farmers that went bankrupt 18 months after his arrival. Now free to do as he pleased, he decided not to go home. He was going to stay in America. William went to New York and began earning a living doing manual labor, selling magazines, gambling, and finally opening a successful little restaurant. But he'd never gotten the acting bug out of his system. In 1895, he returned to the stage. After a few small parts on Broadway, he began touring with actress Fanny Davenport until her death in 1898, which of course ended that job. By that time, William had met Effie Hamilton, a pretty young chorus girl from a wealthy family. They were married in December 1901, and the following year, their daughter Ethel Daisy was born. Effie never returned to the stage, and William decided to take up a new line of work to support his family. With a $25,000 loan that he acquired from his in-laws, he bought two East Side Manhattan antique stores and became a great success. He and his wife and daughter moved into a fashionable home in suburban Larchmont, dined in the finest restaurants, and shopped in all the best stores. In 1908, though, everything fell apart. There was gossip that several vintage items sold in his shops were fakes, and customers began demanding refunds and a fraud investigation. A planned inheritance from Effie's uncle never materialized after the uncle married, then died, leaving everything to his new spouse. William began drinking heavily, and then it was discovered in the summer of that year that he took a vacation trip to the Adirondacks with a woman who wasn't Effie. When his father-in-law called in his loans and his wife's lawyer emptied his bank accounts, William fled New York after emptying the register in one of the antique stores of $600. He never went back. In 1912, Effie's divorce was final. She later remarried and she never saw her ex-husband again. But William only went as far as New Jersey, at first. He gave himself a new name though, William Desmond Taylor, and joined a mediocre acting troupe. After the group disbanded, Taylor went west, doing factory work in Chicago and then gold mining in Colorado and the Yukon. He drank hard, went through a string of women, and seemed destined for a blue-collar, but hey, still colorful existence. But he couldn't still shake off the lure of the theater. In San Francisco, he managed to get a leading role in a show and was discovered by filmmaker Thomas Ince. He talked Taylor into coming to Hollywood and appearing in silent pictures. Taylor worked for Ince for a time and then in 1914 started appearing in movies for Vitagraph. As a side note, when a movie he made was shown in New York, Taylor's daughter Ethel Daisy happened to see it and found her long-lost father. Well, with film roles few and far between, Taylor began to realize he was never going to be a star. He was in his mid-40s and really nothing special on the screen. He decided he would try working behind the camera as a director instead. He was working for the Balboa Amusement Producing Company in Long Beach when he met and fell in love with leading lady Neva Gerber. Unfortunately, Neva was 20 years old, married and had a child, and a much older husband who refused to divorce her. but she got involved with Taylor anyway, but the romance soon soured. Neva learned that Taylor was subject to terrible bouts of depression. Sometimes after completing a new picture, he left on trips to Northern California and always remained vague about where he was going and what he was doing there. Later on, when Neva was finally single again, she decided the troubled director was not exactly what you would call marriage material. However, the two did remain friends. Taylor's career continued to advance, and in the middle 19-teens, he switched studios again. Taylor was brought to Palace Pictures by Julia Crawford Ivers, a screenwriter, producer, and director. When Palace was brought out by Paramount, Julia and Taylor often worked together and maintained a close friendship, even though Julia wanted to be something more. For whatever reason, though, romance never blossomed between them. At Paramount, Taylor became very successful, directing a steady stream of major pictures. But then in 1917, he asked for time off from the studio to join the Canadian Army and serve in World War I. By August 1918, he was based in Nova Scotia for military training and then shipped out to England. Although the war was over by the time he arrived, the filmmaker asked to be stationed in France until his discharge. By the spring of 1919, he had risen to the rank of major. Well, Taylor returned to Hollywood later that same year and got right back to work for Paramount. One of the first major films he made was Anne of Green Gables, starring child actress Mary Miles Minter. He was named to the position of president for the Motion Picture Directors Association and settled into an affluent Hollywood life. He moved from the Los Angeles Athletic Club to one of eight bungalows that made up Alvarado Court, located in a pleasant section of LA and favored by movie industry insiders. Among those living in Alvarado Court was comedy actor Douglas MacLean and his wife, who were members of Taylor's elite social circle. Well, Taylor hired staff to run his household, including Edward F. Sands as a combination secretary, valet, and cook, and Earl Tiffany, who often worked as his driver. During the spring of 1921, Taylor had surgery and went abroad in June to recover. While he was away, he loaned out his bungalow to playwright Edward Knobloch in exchange for the writer's London apartment. To make sure that his guest was comfortable, Taylor foolishly left a signed blank check for Edward Sands to use in case of an emergency. While his employer was away, Sands not only cashed the check in the amount of $5,000, but he also forged a number of smaller checks from Taylor's accounts. A week before Taylor returned, Sands vanished. When he arrived back at home, Taylor discovered that in addition to the missing funds, Sands had also stolen much of his wardrobe, some jewelry, many personal items, and an automobile, which was later found wrecked. Taylor filed a report with the police, and then a few months later, he received a letter from Sands, half-heartedly apologizing for what he'd done. The note also contained two pawn tickets for diamond cufflinks that had been given to the director as a gift. Sands' job at Taylor's home was taken over by a man named Henry Peavy. The diamond cufflinks had been a gift from 27-year-old actor Mabel Normand, who was billed in the 1920s as the Queen of Comedy. She had built her career at Keystone Studios, which was run by her mentor and close friend Max Sennett. In 1918, she'd signed with producer Samuel Goldwyn to make features, and during this time, the popular actress developed a serious cocaine habit. Later, she became close friends with Taylor, who was sympathetic to her drug problem. He tried to get her off the drugs and keep her away from the dealers who were feeding her dangerous and, if the public found out, scandalous habit. Well, another woman in Taylor's complicated life was Mary Miles Minter, who by 1922 was 19 years old. Taylor had directed Mary in three features, and the young girl had fallen deeply in love with him. Under the watchful eye of her controlling stage mother, Charlotte Selby, Mary looked on Taylor as both a father figure and a dashing hero. She fantasized about marrying and continually pursued him, despite his efforts to dissuade her. On Wednesday, February 1st, 1922, Taylor spent the evening at his bungalow, working on his income taxes from the previous year at his desk in the living room. Henry Peavy, Taylor's cook and valet, later told the police that he summoned Taylor to dinner at around 6:30 p.m. The director was eating when he received a telephone call. He was still engaged in this conversation, and no one knows who the call was from, by the way, when Mabel Normand stopped by Taylor's bungalow to pick up two books that he'd recently purchased for her. Peavy let Mabel into the house as Taylor hung up the telephone, and then Henry proceeded to mix them a couple of cocktails. At 7:30, Peavy left for the evening. On his way out, he stopped to speak to Mabel's driver. When he left the house, Taylor and Mabel were sitting on the sofa sipping their cocktails. According to Mabel, she left the bungalow at a little before 8 o'clock. Taylor walked the actress to her car, leaving the front door standing open behind him. She waved as her driver pulled away from the curb and Taylor returned to the house. At midnight, actress Edna Purvance, who also lived at Alvarado Court, returned home and noticed that all the lights were still on at Taylor's house, but she thought it was too late to stop by for a visit. The following morning, Henry Peavy reported to work at 7 a.m. He let himself into the house with his own key. He walked into the living room and found the director's body lying face up on the living room floor. He looked as though he'd fallen, and an overturned chair was lying across his legs. Peavy panicked and began calling for help. As news spread around Alvarado Court, several of the residents hurried over and entered Taylor's home, contaminating the crime scene. When Taylor's new driver, Howard Fellows, arrived at the house, he telephoned the news to his brother, Harry, an assistant director who worked with Taylor at Paramount. Harry contacted Charles Eaton, Paramount's general manager, and told him of Taylor's death. Eaton ordered Harry, along with Julia Crawford Ivers and her son, James, who worked as Taylor's cinematographer, to go directly to Taylor's home. Their instructions were to remove any incriminating evidence that could damage the filmmaker's reputation, which would look bad for the studio. Now remember, at this point, no one had called the police. Julia, James, and Harry Fellows hurried to the bungalow and gathered up anything they could find that might shed a bad light on Taylor. They took letters to Taylor from Mabel Norman, Mary Miles Minter, and Neva Gerber, as well as notes from Ethel Daisy to her father. They also removed all bootleg liquor from the house. By then, the police had been called, and they arrived just minutes after the trio had loaded the letters and booze into the trunk of Harry's car. As detectives were starting to take statements from Taylor's staff and from the neighbors, Paramount General Manager Charles Eaton arrived. The cops knew who he was and didn't stop him from going into the house for a look around. They also didn't question him when he came back out and didn't check to see if he'd moved anything or had taken anything from the crime scene. Well, a short time later, the deputy coroner's assistant arrived, and it was only then that it was discovered that Taylor had been shot in the back. This was a surprise to everyone at the scene, leading to a call to the LAPD's homicide squad. Well, why was everyone so surprised? Well, the first officers at the scene believed that Taylor had died of a stomach hemorrhage. They came to this conclusion because a doctor had earlier been in the neighborhood making a house call and came by to see what all the excitement was about. Without even turning over the body, the doctor offered his snap diagnosis. The cops made a note of it, but failed to obtain the doctor's name. The physician left the scene and was never heard from again. He'd missed a bullet hole, which makes me glad he wasn't my doctor. I'm sure a lot of the cops who were there that day felt the same way. A horde of reporters descended on Alvarado Court, and a flurry of wild accusations, rumors, crazy theories, and outright lies began to be published all over the country. Some newspapers insisted that the killer had to be the missing Edward Sands, a theory that was eventually dismissed. For a time, journalists also suggested that Henry Peavy was the culprit. Since he was African-American and a homosexual, he was a natural culprit. On the day after the murder, Taylor had been scheduled to appear in court on Peavy's behalf in a sexual misconduct allegation. Because of this, it was hinted by the media that Taylor might have also been gay, and this might have had something to do with the murder. Well, Peavy was eventually cleared by the police, but rumors of Taylor being a homosexual, or at least bisexual, have never gone away. Even after Peavy was cleared by the police, a reporter named Floribel Murr remained convinced he was the killer. She believed she could trick Peavy into a confession and get a great scoop for herself. She enlisted two men, Frank Carson and Al Weinshank, in her plan. Muir went to Peavy and offered him $10 to guide her to the location of Taylor's grave at Hollywood Memorial Park. Peavy agreed, and he rode along with Muir and Frank Carson to the cemetery. They found Taylor's gravesite and got out of the car. As they did, Weinshank, who was covered with a white sheet, came running toward them and shouted, "I am the ghost of William Desmond Taylor. You murdered me. Confess, Peavy." Peavy burst out laughing. Then, realizing what the trio had tried to do with him, he loudly and furiously denounced them all. On a side note, Al Weinshank later became one of the gangsters killed during the infamous 1929 St. Valentine's Day massacre in Chicago. Well, with stories, rumors, and innuendos running rampant, it was hard to tell where the truth ended and the fiction began. Taylor's closest neighbors, the McLeans, told the police their maid had heard someone in the alley between their house and Taylor's after 7 p.m. on the night of the murder. Later, when Mrs. McLean heard a noise that sounded like a car backfiring, she looked outside and saw a person leaving Taylor's bungalow and walking calmly away. She described this person as a, quote, roughly dressed man, wearing a cap and a scarf. However, it was later learned that a friend of Taylor's had borrowed his car for the evening and had returned it to his house that same night. After parking it in the garage, he went to the door, but when he got no reply, he left. The police believed he was the figure seen by Mrs. McLean that night. More baffling pieces were added to the puzzle, and the investigation was certainly not helped by L.A. District Attorney Thomas Woolwine, who had close ties to all the major players in the movie industry. One newspaper accused the district attorney of, quote, erecting a barricade of silence between the searchers for truth and the truth itself. The investigation was being badly handled, even hamstrung, in an effort to protect Taylor and the studio. But some of the witnesses hindered things even further by withholding information in an effort to protect their own reputations. When Mabel Norman was questioned by the police, she did her best to downplay any romantic relationship she'd had with Taylor. She was also deliberately vague on other issues involving herself and the director, especially when it came to her drug problem and Taylor's efforts to help her break the habit. Well, the newspapers continued to hamper the investigation, too. In a rush for lurid headlines, journalists were quick to report the discovery of Mary Miles Winter's monogrammed pink lingerie at Taylor's house. The young actress denied she'd left any underwear there, and the lingerie, well, it turned out to be a monogrammed handkerchief that she'd once loaned him. However, the story suggested to the public that the supposedly innocent Mary and the much older Taylor were having a clandestine romance. This theory was given further credence by a note that was discovered tucked inside of a book of erotic poetry that was on the shelf in Taylor's well-stocked library. On the stationery were the initials MMM, and the letter read, "Dearest, I love you, I love you, I love you," followed by a whole bunch of X's that, of course, mean kisses. "Yours always, Mary." When Mary was questioned about this, she admitted, quote, "I did love William Desmond Taylor. I loved him deeply and tenderly with all of the admiration that a young girl gives to a man with the poise and position of Mr. Taylor." Well, those who knew Taylor were well aware he tried to discourage Mary from the crush she had on him, and no proof was ever discovered that even hinted of a sexual relationship between them, but that didn't stop people from talking about it. Nor did it stop Mary from dreaming about it. In fact, at Taylor's packed funeral, Mary approached the director's casket and kissed his corpse full on the lips. She then caused a stir in the room as she loudly announced that the corpse had spoken to her. "He whispered something to me," she said. "It sounded like, I shall love you always, Mary." This bit of theatrics, along with the scandal itself, helped to destroy her film career. The coroner's inquest was held on February 4th, 1922, and lasted less than an hour. Not all the witnesses on hand were called to testify. The coroner's jury quickly concluded that the director's death had been caused by a gunshot wound by, quote, some person or persons unknown to this jury. To many observers, the murder investigation appeared to be a series of contrivances used to hush up potential scandals. A Chicago Tribune article stated, quote, 20 people are said to be under suspicion. 20,000 theories of the crime are being aired, but there's not been one arrest and not one clue. It's believed that movie interests would spend $1 million not to catch the murderer, to prevent the real truth from coming out. Well, to battle such sentiment, the film studios established a special committee, allegedly to help the press deal with the case, but it really existed to try and get everyone to forget about the case as quickly as possible. A few reporters who didn't bow to pressure from the special committee claimed to be intimidated by the LAPD. Well, the case was never officially resolved, and as the years passed, bits of truth continued to emerge, almost lost amidst the stories, rumors, and Hollywood legends. Speculation included the idea that Taylor was murdered by a hired killer who was working for one of the drug dealers servicing Mabel Norman. Friends of Taylor knew that he had appealed to the U.S. attorney a short time before his death to try and combat a narcotics ring that was selling cocaine to Mabel. A dozen known addicts and dealers were questioned, and detectives even traveled to Folsom Prison to question two convicts that the warden implicated in Taylor's murder. One of them said that the other had killed the director at the urging of a well-known actress, who resented Taylor for interfering with her dope supply. After an exhaustive investigation, detectives became convinced the convicts were lying in hopes of getting transferred to a minimum security facility. But it is true that the most popular murder theories have involved Mabel Norman and Mary Miles Minter, one or the other of whom are said to have murdered Taylor during a lover's spat. Another bit of guesswork suggests the killer was Mary's manipulative mother, who was also a jealous rival for the director's love. Well, Mabel's career was destroyed by the Taylor scandal, as well as by another incident that occurred shortly afterward involving her chauffeur and the murder of a Hollywood playboy. She made a few additional films, but by then her drug abuse had ruined her health. She died in 1930 from tuberculosis and pneumonia. Mary Miles Minter retired permanently from the screen in 1924. She spent the next few decades feuding with her overbearing mother, who finally died, leaving Mary in peace in 1957. Mary died a recluse in 1984. Weird stories continue to circulate about the case for years. District Attorney Woolwine, the man who probably knew more about the case than anyone else, resigned due to poor health and died soon after. In 1926, his successor, Asa Keys, reopened the Taylor case and announced that an arrest was imminent. But the arrest never happened. Why? Keys claimed that vital evidence kept in a locked cabinet in his office mysteriously vanished. The case went cold once again. Keys later died after going to prison for accepting a bribe in a $1 million oil scandal. In 1929, the mystery was resurrected again when F.W. Richardson, a former California governor, stated that back in 1926, he'd received positive information that a certain top screen actress had killed Taylor, but he was unable to do anything about it because of the corrupt conditions that existed in the LAPD at the time. Richardson implied that the film industry had bribed officials to bury the investigation. But Richard's startling announcement led to more dead ends, and nothing ever came of it. In 1943, a man arrested on federal narcotics charges in Indiana offered to name William Desmond Taylor's killer in return for immunity. The government refused to make the deal, and the man remained silent and died of pneumonia in the prison hospital. Well, at that point, any real investigation into the case came to an end. From time to time, writers, reporters, and retired cops will come forward and claim that the killer was indeed known to the authorities at the time, but no one could do anything about it. Some have mysteriously spoken of an actress or an actor who was involved, but no definitive proof has ever been offered. The spectacular William Desmond Taylor case has become a classic Hollywood murder mystery over the years, but this is one that's never going to be solved in the last pages of a book or in the final reel of anything on the silver screen.
Have you ever wanted to learn a new language? And I don't mean like spells or incantations to trap spirits, you weirdos. I mean like a new language that could help you start communicating with more people on this plane today. Then I need to tell you about Rosetta Stone. Look, you know the brand, you know the name. They have the expertise and a 30-year legacy, which makes them more qualified than ever to help you learn a new language today. They've helped millions of people build the fluency and confidence to speak new languages. Now, this is the part where Troy would tell me that I made some kind of grammatical error, but he's not here right now, so like, I don't know, it's like speaking tongues. Rosetta Stone focuses on speaking practice for real-life scenarios to get you ready for real conversations with real people. Or maybe you can even learn how to use some different types of Ouija boards. I don't know. Either way, Rosetta Stone can help you learn faster and retain your new language better. Honestly, Rosetta Stone really would have come in handy for season 4 of New Orleans because I know we butchered some of those French names, and I apologize once again. Now, you all know I have a 9-to-5 job when I'm not at the podcast factory, and Rosetta Stone actually helped me not make a total fool out of myself while I was in Brazil interviewing celebrities. Obrigado. And now I want to help you. So don't put off learning that new language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, American Hauntings podcast listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today. Rosetta Stone, how language is learned. Wait, by the way, Troy, like where do words come from? Hey, no, don't walk away. Oh, Troy, where?
There's one thing that the American Hauntings podcast knows about, and that's mothers. We featured a lot of great mothers in a lot of our episodes. Pearl Curran, Julia Lemp, Sarah Moore, Marie Laveau, Jane Mansfield, Tamsin Donner, Delphine LaLaurie, Belle Gunness. Okay, maybe leave out those last two. But what I'm saying is that with Mother's Day coming soon, you need a truly special gift for your mom because, well, she's not Belle Gunness. So let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that literally turns your mom's life story into a book. So here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send your mom a question in her email, the same way she sends you questions about your dating life or when you plan to give her grandkids. Anyway, these can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you want to ask. She replies by either typing in the answers or by recording her own voice. Then MyLifeInABook.com compiles all her responses into a keepsake book, and they can create an audiobook that uses her voice recordings, preserving her voice and her stories forever. As anyone who doesn't have their mom around anymore can tell you, having your mother's stories about growing up, being a kid, and overcoming life's challenges will be something that you and your kids will treasure. And let's be honest, your mom has given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a very cool way to share them. Honestly, I decided to try this out for myself, and I sent it to my mom, and she's not exactly a whiz at computers, but she still found it really easy to use. My mom might have had a little more unusual childhood than a lot of mothers do, so I'm really glad to have this. And I think you'll be glad to give one to your mother, too. So check out MyLifeInABook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS for 10% off today.
Probably couldn't even read the numbers on the speedometer to tell me how fast he was going. All right, you ready?
Sure.
Okay. Thanks for tuning in to the American Hauntings podcast, the show where we discuss history, hauntings, legends, lore, the dark side of American history, and the real life scary stories that sometimes happen to me. We are now in season 5 of the podcast, Haunted Hollywood. I'm your co-host, Cody Beck, and with me is my co-host, author, historian, crime buff, the founder of American Hauntings, Troy Taylor.
Hey, so we're not going to give you any details on what we've just been sharing, but Cody just had a near-death experience recently, so we were just covering that before we started recording.
I appreciate it. I've only told a couple people too, and I really appreciate that you understood the gravity of the situation.
Yeah.
Other people are like, dude, you're just like, it's just because you do this true crime stuff.
Yeah, and I'm like, when you're in someone's car and there's a bag of zip ties, you kind of go, whoa.
I know.
Who carries around a bag of zip ties, right?
Apparently hunters or murderers.
Right.
Maybe both.
Right.
Oh, geez. Well, okay. Enough about me. What's been going on with you and what do we have going on? You did a River Road tour.
Yeah,
yesterday.
I did last night. We're recording this on Saturday the 14th, which is not nearly as ominous as Friday the 13th.
I know. We fucked up on that.
But anyway, we did a River Road tour on the 13th. It was a lot of fun. We had a really, really good group. And those are starting to sell out for the fall already.
Nice.
People are getting excited. I mean, it's been a busy summer. It's turned into one. So it's been nice. A lot of events. And, one thing I wanted to do is our conference podcast came out last week. I hadn't had a chance to a live show. Thank everybody who attended. It was a really good time. It really came together well. We were really pleased with it.
Yeah.
We've been making a lot of plans for next year. So we'll start putting that together. We've already started putting it together because, as soon as it's over, you got to start. And we're a month later, so we're really a little behind, really.
Dude,
but
you guys had the coolest prizes this year. They get better
finding it's just, I don't know, it just all worked out. And I want to say, it's because we had an extra year to do it, but honestly, I didn't do anything last year. So once we realized we weren't having it, I'm like,
it doesn't matter.
So, we always stay on the hunt for things, and that's just a constant ongoing thing. Yeah. So yeah, it was fun.
It was awesome. I met so many people, so many listeners of the podcast. I took so many pictures. I probably don't even remember. And then I got so many stories because I do the ghost story
more
stuff.
Than ever.
More than ever. And for also, sure. I didn't just get ghost stories. I got like skinwalkers, yeah, aliens, like a bunch of weird shit.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
and it was a lot of fun.
So and we'll be, you'll hear those. I mean, we had some already this past week. We've got more coming, and then we'll probably put a lot of them on as bonus episodes for Patreon.
I'm thinking
so.
Yeah, because I got enough.
That'll be fun. Yeah, there'll be a ton. I couldn't believe how many you got this year.
I had an hour and 20 minutes just on Saturday worth of five, six minute stories.
Yeah, and you were doing it on Friday too. So, yeah. I mean, yeah, there was a lot. There was every time I'd walk past, there'd be somebody else at the table. And that's new. I mean, we'd always get a few, but we never had as many as we did this year.
Nice because people were finally telling their friends and got a crazy story. Go tell this kid.
Go tell Cody. Yeah,
and then and I was doing that on Friday because Lisa's like, I need you to do crowd control. And I'm walking around. I was like, yeah, these guys are really rambunctious right now. They're all playing like Candy Crush on their phones. And I'm like, come tell me a weird story.
Sitting around waiting for us to open doors.
But people, they loved it. I remember I talked to a group of five sisters that all grew up in the same haunted house. I got great stories from all of them. And
it's cool.
Just met a lot of people, and I definitely had the conference hangover after that because you get to see all your friends and stuff. And
I mean, who we hadn't seen in 2 years.
Yeah,
and then, it's over.
Troy, I mean, we karaoke'd, okay? Like, that's how close everybody was. Sorry.
We didn't karaoke.
No, sorry.
Cody did. I did not.
I did karaoke.
We did have a lot of fun.
Yeah.
That was a good time.
How'd the breakfast go?
Good. Everybody showed up, and, you know, everybody said how great it was to have something to do the morning after the conference, like one last thing.
It was fun. Edgar Allan Poe,
right? We did the Poe one for breakfast on Sunday, and we'll probably keep doing that. It's a fun little addition, and you know, I really enjoyed doing it. So you know, awesome. And also keeps me from being completely hungover on Sunday morning. See, so there's a bonus to that too.
Smart.
So, yeah. So
well, aside from the conference, what else you got?
Well, my last book came out right before the conference. That Hell Hath No Fury book, which turned out to be a really good one. It's good, really good seller. People have really liked it. I enjoyed it. My plan is to make it part of an ongoing series, and hopefully we've got a surprise coming with that one later on. I cannot talk about right now.
I'm excited for that.
So we will see what happens with that. My fingers are crossed, so we'll see. But so
you just need women to keep going crazy, killing people, right?
Works great because there's so much material there.
Right. There's a lot to work with.
Yeah. So, but yeah, we've been doing. You know, I mean, it's starting to get. It's not fall, but it's starting to feel like fall. People go back to school and stuff. So we end up with, you know, all of our ghost tours on sale. The River Road tours are on sale. All the dinner things are coming up. So if you want to check any of them out, go to dinnerandspirits.com, or you can just go to AmericanHauntings.net and see everything there. We'll start announcing 2022 things soon.
Yeah.
The next conference speakers, Dead of Winter, all that stuff. I mean, this year is flying by now. So
it is.
We'll have a lot of that stuff going. And I will also tell you that on September 10th, I am finally releasing the uncensored edition of The Devil Came to St. Louis.
I just posted the
cover of it yesterday. And, you know, people are like, oh, no, I read that book. No. Yeah, no, I actually haven't.
So aside from using the real name.
Yeah, there'll be all the names. There's a lot more info, the things that I, you know, either would reveal too much about the family or whatever. Mm-hmm. And now I'm able to do all that.
Right.
So
awesome.
My agreement has come to an end. So now I can post the stuff that I've been wanting to post, which now some of it actually makes more sense when you start. I mean, it's weird. It's just weird because
get some more context.
Or? Yeah, you do. There's a lot more context that can be discussed that couldn't be discussed before. So anyway, I'm excited about it because it's been one of those things. It's been something I've been working on for 15 years. And it's exciting to finally get to do something big with it. So,
yeah.
Anyway, but that's coming out on the 10th, so that'll be coming up. And, we'll have more stuff to talk about, you know, in the next couple of shows.
Totally. Well, I'm excited for you. I'm excited for that. I had somebody reach out the other day, and they sent me altonhauntings.com. And they said, are you affiliated with any of this? And I was like, of course. I mean, look at that. I was like, look at the little favicon thing. It's, you know, the skull you see in all the American Hauntings, Hauntings, Inc.
And it also says podcast at the top.
Does it?
You can click on it and it goes to the podcast page. So,
she's not that bright. Anyway, but I was like, yeah, of course. Like, you know, it's something spooky going on around here. We got tons of websites because listen to the podcast. We plug them all the time. And I talk about how many domains that you own and how. God,
I don't remember how many. It's a lot.
So. It's got to be a lot. Oh, geez. All right. Well, let's talk about some listener reviews.
Sure.
I'm only going to read one today because it's kind of long, but it's got a lot to it, and I want to dive into it, and I'm really I actually am excited about this.
Okay.
The title is, I have gone through quite a lot of podcasts to land on this gym, and it's from Chimera1818. So bear with me. It's long, but it's worth it. It says, first, I must definitely comment on the quality of the audio. I've listened to the first shows and jumped around to most of the recent shows, and the quality is a massive improvement. It is obvious not only your equipment has improved, but so has your technique. As an old studio session drummer in another life, I can attest that if you do not know how to use the equipment, it doesn't matter how nice it is. Thank you very much. That means like a lot. Second, the production of the show in conjunction with Troy's cadence, inflection, and tone is darn near addictive. I swear Troy could be reading a laxative commercial and I would still listen to the whole thing. Also, I'm really liking the most recent bumper music compared to the initial podcast. That sounds like a shot at Charlie Brackus, which I, you know what? Get him. Just drag his ass. But Troy, they like the way you talk. This third, the composition of the story.
If only they knew how much work it took to put this together.
Sometimes the way that Troy has like a really long pause in between stuff. I cut out his like ums and ers or like anytime. Sometimes I've actually made you say words in the podcast that you didn't really say by combining two syllables.
Yeah. If anybody ever knew, I mean, how, you know, when I put those monologues together and
it's amazing.
Cody's like, God damn, because I'll like keep messing something up and then I get to giggling and I can't stop and I'm like, I can't figure out why I can't say things. And
I don't know if
you guys have no idea.
I don't know if I like it better when you get giggly or when you get,
when I get mad. I get mad at myself for messing something up over and over again.
The curse word combination. Okay. So third, the composition of the stories are on a whole nother level. I rarely will read the title and think, this story may be a bit slow, but within the first few sentences, I've been hooked and totally engrossed on the tale that is being spun. I've quickly learned to listen to the next episode, the next podcast, no matter the title. That's good too, because sometimes I've wondered about are people going to know the Babes of Inglewood or we're talking about. Fourth, the discussion at the very end is very unique and refreshing. It is like I'm sitting down with a storyteller for a drink, because that's what we do, to discuss certain intricacies that pique my interest. Cody has really improved in this role over the podcast. This part, in my opinion, can be most difficult, as Cody has to come poignant with questions to add texture and depth, as well as pull the listener out of the darkness of the story that Troy does so well weaving. My only critique, parentheses, please don't yell at me, Cody, is sometimes the recaps can be a little redundant, in my opinion, as Troy has done such an amazing job burning the story in my mind. But with that being said, I can get lost in the recaps are sometimes appreciated and needed, so maybe Cody's correct in doing this. Anyway, long review, but I think you guys deserve it with the amount of love and attention you give to your podcast. Thank you for your efforts. So thank you for that review. One of the reasons I wanted to talk about this is that I wanted to explain a little bit about my process and how I've thought about maybe refining it for the future. And I feel like, Troy, the best time for us to discuss business things with the podcast is live on the podcast. So what I do, though, just so people know, is Troy will send me an outline of the episode, basically his whole monologue, except for some of the things that he might change on the fly.
Yeah, or add in.
Or add in, or ad lib or, you know, whatever. And so I go through that and I have my own doc and I pretty much sum it all up in my own document. And the thing is, I never know what's going to be important later on and what's not. So I try to like do like a little book report and sum everything up. And then as I'm going, I'll add in like questions in little sub bullet points or jokes or whatever. And then I go give it a second pass after I'm done. And I say, okay, maybe I can cut this out, cut that out. I've thought more about this, or now this makes sense. So this question doesn't add up, that sort of thing. But I've thought about it before. And I think it's because the listeners, they hear your monologue and then immediately hear the conversation.
Mm-hmm. We don't do it that way.
So it's not as fresh in my mind. But I have wondered about maybe I should just do a quick summary of like a, you know, 1 minute summary and then just dive into questions. So if you guys have thoughts on, like, is it helpful when I kind of do a recap play by play, or would you just rather us get into discussions and questions and thoughts in future episodes? I don't know. I'm always kind of trying to refine it a little bit.
Yeah.
American Hauntings Podcast @gmail.com. Hit me up, or hit me up on Twitter or Instagram or something. Cause that review is, it's something I definitely think about. I've wondered, is it redundant? Is it helpful? It's probably a little bit of both. Depending on who you are, my memory is not good enough to remember. Like, so I wouldn't know, because you hear Troy talk about so many people, so many dates, especially I think about like the limp episodes.
Yeah.
Oh, I'd have been so lost.
Yeah. Like, well, and you know, the other thing is that I did this a week ago, and then we get here and I end up pulling it up in front of me so I can look at my script, because
that's true.
I don't, you know, remember every single thing that I put in a
It seems
monologue.
Like you do, though.
I mean, I probably do, but I like to have stuff in front of me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Even if I remember it, I still like to have it in front of me. You know, that's I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess we can just see what people think.
See what people think. I'm curious, because that is very fair feedback, and I am curious. Yeah. And I've learned a lot to go back a second time and kind of cull my stuff down, especially because there have been episodes where Troy and I are talking and he'll interrupt me and go, dude, okay, look, we just
covered that.
He's like, or he'll be like, we don't have enough time.
Yeah, we cannot cover every single point of this story.
And so I've gotten better about cutting stuff out. And also in real time, a lot of times Troy will jump ahead and start talking about little bullet points I have, and I'll X them out, or I'll cross them out, or erase them, or whatever. So I kind of, it's a lot of stuff on the fly, but I hope you all are enjoying it, and thank you for the review, and I hope you don't feel like I'm yelling at you. I just really appreciate everything, and all the stuff you said about the audio stuff, like, that is really, really helpful. Yeah. So, okay, 20 minutes later, you ready to dive in to Hollywood's original unsolved mystery? So February 1st, 1922, William Desmond Taylor, any relation?
Nope.
Okay, I had
it's
to.
It's not his real name
waiting for so long, right? Famous movie director's murdered in L.A. First assumed he died of natural causes, but apparently he'd been shot in the back by a .38. It's never solved. There's a lot of suspects. Studio execs at Paramount Studios didn't help anything
Once
with their
again,
damage control.
Once again, I mean,
control.
This is like time every and time, again. Time we've talked about this.
Yes.
It's always,
things
were different back then.
You're going to talk about it, but the fact that, like you said, like, I'm glad that guy wasn't my doctor, like the kind that came in.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never seen anybody get shot with a .38, but
You'd like to think you'd notice, especially if you're a doctor, but
I
whatever.
Guess you're not supposed to move the body, maybe, but
well,
I
shouldn't have been in there anyway. What difference does it make? No one
should have been in there. Okay, who was William Desmond Taylor? So, born William Cunningham Dean Tanner on April 26, 1872, just south of Dublin. Said his father ran a home like a military barracks, left home early, began performing on stage. His father was pissed. It was like, no son of mine. Sent him to a farmer university in America that went bankrupt.
Weird?
I mean, yes, it is. But also, it's like he's so far away from home and that shuts down. I'd just be like, give a middle finger to dad. Mm-hmm. It's like, all right, I'm just living my life in America now. So he moves to New York City, but he makes something of himself. Like, this is like the American dream, pretty much, right? Begins touring with actress Fanny Davenport until her death in 1898. Meets Effie Hamilton. They marry in December 1901, and they had a daughter the following year. Takes up a loan and opens up two East Manhattan antique stores. This sounds fun.
Yeah.
I think that would be really cool.
Yeah, I mean, although, you know, at that point, what's an antique in 1901? Did you wonder about that, too?
I didn't, but now I am curious.
I'm kind of like, they must have been selling, like, you know, like stuff from England from like the 1700s or something. I mean, now you antiques are, you know, 19th century,
stuff
early 20th
right
century,
here.
Right? Yeah. But in 1901, what's an antique?
I think, you know, there was an original wheel made out of rock.
Right, exactly. Then when, you know, people start saying, oh, but some of this stuff turned out to be fakes. That's why I think it must be like, it must have been like Chippendale furniture and fancy, that kind of stuff. And then, you know, some of it turned out to be fake and didn't, you know, have the prominence that it was supposed to have. And that's when he got into trouble.
Right. You know? Yeah. So, it missed out on a planned inheritance. He starts getting some fraud things, starts drinking a lot, going on vacation with another woman. Father-in-law calls in the loans, wife lawyers empty the bank accounts. So he just says, fuck it, takes all the money, $600 out of one of those cash registers and goes all the way to New Jersey.
I know. That's all the further he went.
Right.
But at the time, that's where, and you know, and he joins up with this acting troupe. But the thing was, though, This is still, you know, this is around 1910, so it was still a little early, but New Jersey is where the movie companies started. I mean, the movie business started in New Jersey, and then it moved to Chicago. Okay. Because they were trying to stay one step ahead of Thomas Edison.
Oh, right,
Remember we talked about that.
I was like, this, why does
this
sound
really Edison's in New Jersey, right? So that's where people are initially doing filming. But, I mean, at this point, he wasn't getting involved in the movies. And but, you know, he would. You know, he would later on when they were in, you know, in New York and New Jersey and then Chicago, then finally California. So.
Got it. You ever been to Jersey?
Once, long time ago. Yeah. I keep wanting to go back because I friends run the Weird New Jersey magazine.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, I did Weird Illinois and that stuff. And so they're always like, man, come on out. We'll take you all these places. And it's just, I don't know. I haven't been able to get up and go, oh, God, I got to go to New Jersey.
Just,
you know, I don't know. It'd be kind of cool to see a lot of the stuff, you know.
I used to fly in and out of Newark all the time.
Oh,
and then
yeah, you're living in New York. Right.
Well, I used to do that because I could get home. I'd take like three buses, but it was like $12 mm-hmm. and like a taxi or anything. I didn't have that kind of money mm-hmm. for a $50, you know, taxi ride or whatever. I did go to Hoboken one time with my buddy Kwame, which was a whole thing. Yeah, so Jersey, yeah, Garden State. Yeah. Anyway, if we have fans from New Jersey, yeah, let us know. So he bebops around doing different jobs. Then he's discovered in Hollywood. Knew he'd never be a star because he's kind of old at that point and just kind of, he's like, you know what, screw it. I can probably make more money doing like work behind the camera.
Yeah.
I'm guessing. Gets into Palace Pictures, bought out by Paramount. That's how he ends up there. Then this guy just, so did he get drafted? Did he just jump into
World
War I?
No, he joined up. Well, and you know, and he joined the Canadian Army because the reason why is the beginning of the war, the United States was not involved and they wouldn't get involved until toward the end of the war. Mm-hmm. We didn't. We sat out most of it. But a lot of guys who wanted to go and fight the Russian the German threat joined up with like the English or, you know, the British and the Canadian armies and then ended up in the war. But he did it a little too late.
Sure. You know, well, I think he timed it perfectly.
Well, I know, but I think he planned to actually join up to really serve. But by the time he finished his training and everything, by the time he got to England, war was over. But he did serve out the rest of his time, I mean, you know, and did really well at it.
Yeah. So did you, back then, like, did they just want bodies or did they have to say, like, I'm Canadian? Or did
I'm not sure about that. I think that you had to, I remember at the beginning of World War II, it was the same thing. A lot of, especially pilots, went over to England so that they could fly. And, you know, a lot of guys did.
Yeah.
And before that, a lot of those guys went to China to fight against the Japanese. The Flying Tigers they were all Americans. And they joined up and were flying and fighting against the Japanese. Mm. It was something that people wanted to get involved in the war, but we still weren't in it yet.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of guys went and joined up with the RAF. So they could fly, and they took them because they needed skilled pilots. And I think this was probably a lot of the same thing. I know a lot of guys did that with World War I too. I haven't read about it as much, but I've read about it quite a bit with World War II.
Gotcha.
But I'm sure that's what was going on here.
Sure.
So.
Well, side note, as far as like measuring, like, oh geez, how can I say this politely? The biggest balls you can have. There's gladiators back in the day, and then people that have been in like dogfights planes.
Right, in planes made out of wood and canvas.
The craziest shit.
Oh, I know.
I cannot imagine.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Anyway, thank you for your service. Okay, so this guy's all over the place. Goes back to Hollywood and gets right back to work.
Mm-hmm.
Starts to rise up. Gets a fancy lifestyle again. So you really see this guy go through a lot of ups and downs
all over the place. And I think that's what is making, you know, what makes him an interesting character.
Yeah,
I noted on there, even before he got involved in the movies, he would have had a very colorful life no matter what.
Yeah.
So all the things he'd already done, and then he gets involved in the movies too.
Yeah. Well, it seems like no matter how down he gets, he's able to figure it out, whether it's through hard work or falling ass backwards.
Until the end.
Until the end. Doesn't get
up from that one.
Didn't get up from that. You're right. So he hires staff for his new house and new lifestyle and things like that. This is spring 1921. He has surgery and swaps apartments with playwright Edward Knobloch. And he left behind this guy, Edward Sands, who kind of hired to like run the household and do different things for him. This guy steals a shit ton of stuff for like money and pieces out, takes clothes, jewelry, car, crashes it, all that. Eventually sends a letter saying, like, my bad.
Sorry.
Yes. Yeah. Sands' job's eventually taken over by Henry Peavy, who we'll get back to later. You talk about how his complicated life is filled with complicated women, like Mabel Normand, who's billed as 1920s Queen of Comedy.
She's really funny.
I want to see something.
There are some shorts. I wanted to see, too. I mean, I knew who she was and things, but I hadn't really looked at anything in a long time. So I pulled up there's some shorts online that you can find, the Keystone stuff that she did.
Okay.
And she's just kind of a fun, crazy, you know, pratfall kind of, and she's entertaining.
Yeah.
But had a, you know, massive coke habit.
Yeah.
Which, again, here's the thing, and I'm not, this is not an endorsement of it. I'm just saying that.
I get it.
No, at the time, in the 1920s, when you're doing this crazy Keystone comedy stuff, and if you've ever watched any of those old shorts, the Keystone Cops, or even any of old Chaplin's stuff, there was no dialogue. So you had to be funny, physically funny.
Animated.
Yeah, very, very animated. Much more than you would ever have to be later on once you had sound. So, you know, there's all kinds of crazy stunts. Everybody did all their own stunts. They did all their own parts. And so they found it conducive to doing very physical comedy to be, you know, high as a kite.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's what got it started, you know. But and the other thing was, is that people would come out to Hollywood. They'd come from small towns across the country or wherever, and they'd end up in Hollywood where all of this stuff is suddenly at your fingertips. You know, it's like Prohibition didn't exist, you know, in Hollywood. There's booze everywhere because the studios controlled everything. There's drugs, any kind of drugs you could possibly want, because they're artists. I mean, they are not they are a new breed of artist in this country.
Interesting.
And artists always have a, you know, a different lifestyle than a lot of people do. And I mean, like I said, I'm not excusing it. I'm not even endorsing it.
Explaining.
I'm just saying
it.
That, you know, that's what got a lot of this started. But Taylor didn't, you know, was really put off by her drug use. And there have been a lot of stories about, you know, he did try to get, you know, he did arrange to have some guys arrested. He was turning state's evidence. He physically confronted a couple of her dealers. So, I mean, you know, there are a lot of suspects in this murder. And it didn't necessarily have to be one of these women who were, you know, in his circle.
Yeah.
Because there were a lot. I mean, he was a good looking guy and his, you know, middle aged guy. And, you know, women liked him. People liked him. I mean, he seemed like a decent guy, and he was trying to do the right thing by Mabel. And I don't think, honestly, if I had to guess, I wouldn't say neither Mabel nor Mary had anything to do with his death.
You think it was the drug people?
I had to guess, it would be someone that he'd angered.
Yeah.
Because he did go to, you know, the drug enforcement people to get some of these dealers and you know, they would have lost a lot of money.
Yeah.
He was trying to keep them off the studio lot.
Hit the wall.
It wasn't just keep him away from Mabel. It was keep him off the lot. Well, geez, that's a lot of money.
It's your clientele.
That is your client. I mean, that was their customer base. So, yeah, I don't know. And, you know, he just kind of felt like if the public finds out, you know, we got other things going on here that people don't, you know, we got enough bad press, and people find out that somebody like Mabel, who's, again, one of those America's sweethearts kind of girls, you know, that people, she was beloved, and everybody finds out she's got a huge coke habit. It's not, you know, this isn't the 1970s at this point. It's the 1920s. A little different. You know?
Sure. Yeah. Have you seen that meme that talks about how, like, the rehab for cocaine should just be you completely sober in a room with two people who are high on cocaine?
Yeah.
You have to talk to them for an
exactly.
hour.
That would do it. Yeah, I think so, too.
Gosh, that would do it. Moving on to, more women. You're talking about males. Mary Miles Minter.
Yes.
Sorry, jeez, the alliteration there. A young actress who's in love with Taylor, also looks at him as, like, a father figure. And we've seen those kind of weird relationships.
I mean, she was madly in love with him. You know, he had directed her in Anne of Green Gables and a couple of other things. And it was one of those situations, you know, how will you watch a movie and, you know, everybody's supposed to be in high school and you're like, okay, it's like 90210. Okay, the dude's like 30, he's losing his hair.
Just, I mean, my self-esteem.
He's not in high school, you know,
so down
and
from that
so
shit.
It's not, yeah, it's like, You know, and that's what it was with her. She's playing these very young parts. Mm-hmm. A lot of actresses did, though. I mean, at that time. Again, you're talking about silent films, so they don't have to talk. They just have to look young,
yeah.
You know, and look cute. Claire Beau. I mean, there were lots of them who were, you know, in that category. But Mary Miles Minter was never a superstar, but she was well-liked and well-known and played these young girl characters. And again, so it's going to look bad. If for some reason, and I don't think he had any involvement with her at all, but she was madly in love with him. And her mother was a whack job. If you ever get a chance to dig really deep into this story and really find out more about Charlotte Selby, and if there was someone he knew involved in the murder, I would put it on her. It's either her or the drug dealers, in my opinion.
Okay.
I think that she was worried about her meal ticket. You know,
we remember when
we talked about Jean Harlow, yep. The same kind of deal.
Yep.
She was more worried about her meal ticket than anything. And, you know, if rumors started that, you know, her 19-year-old daughter was sleeping with, you know, William Desmond Taylor, it's going to look bad. It's going to ruin Mary's career. As it turned out, ruins her career anyway.
Yeah.
Just because she gets tarred with the same brush from all this stuff after the murder. But
do you think, I'm curious, so in this story and then the next episode we're going to talk about, there's a big deal with, and previous stories, we talk about studios wanting to, you know, cover up any scandals that makes them look bad and all that. Do you think, does that end up being more detrimental to them
in
the long run?
Not always. Not so much? I mean, well, here's a perfect example that I always like to use. Rock Hudson was like the stud of the movies for decades.
And he's the one that I mistakenly said Clark Gable and I meant
right,
Rock,
right, Rock okay, Hudson. Yes, yes. And so, but no one knew he was gay all along.
Yeah.
Of course he was. It didn't like he suddenly became gay in the 80s. I mean, right. He had been all along, but nobody talked about it. The studios covered it up for years and years. And the people who did know about it liked him because he's a good dude. And they liked him so much, they never talked about it. Same way with the guy that played Mr. Brady. I can't think of his name off the top of my head, but
is it Mike something?
No, it was Mike Brady was the name, but the same thing though. I mean, you know, everybody just kept it quiet.
I did know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, but you know, and then because it wasn't accepted, finally it becomes accepted. We start talking about it. I mean, you know, I mean, honestly, there were people who probably till the day he died would have swore that Liberace was straight. I mean, because no one ever talked about it.
Yeah.
Because you couldn't talk about it. And Hollywood, I mean, they send him out with women and things and, you know, right. Or set up arranged marriages and things to try to make sure that they're, and it, they didn't care about the actors, as we've discovered in all of these stories. The studios didn't give a shit about the actors. All they cared about was their bottom line. And so if, you know, if there was something at Taylor's house that looked bad after he was murdered, they wanted it gone. They didn't care about his reputation. It was how it was going to affect the studio.
Sure.
Because, you know, if there was some kind of backlash against his films that were found out later on, look what would happen. I mean, look what happens now. It's not that much different. I mean, now, you know, somebody does something 20 years after they made a great film, and then suddenly now, you know, you look back at their old movies. How many times have you heard somebody say, yeah, it's kind of problematic now?
Yeah.
Well, but it wasn't 20 years ago and it was a great film. But yes, I get what you're saying.
Right.
And,
right.
And yes, this is a problem person.
Sure.
So that's what, but
Animal House.
Yeah. I mean, but so I guess the point is here is that the studios could not afford scandals to get out.
Okay, fair enough.
You know, that's why, well, the next episode, we've already recorded except for this part of it. It's like the original canceled culture guy.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, so let's continue on with this. Let me get to any other questions you have.
Sure. Yeah. I just love that someone in their car is screaming right now. Cause I'm like, Christopher Knight. No, that's not it.
No,
someone's
not
screaming
it.
This guy's
Robert
name.
Robert Reed.
There you go. Sure.
Is it Robert?
No. Yeah. It's gotta be Robert.
Right? I don't know. It's if only we had a way to look it up.
I know and I'm kidding. It's so funny because I was trying not to do that.
Yeah, I know. Me too. It is. I think it is Reed.
Right? If it's not, I'm just going to cut this out so nobody knows that we were so dumb.
Okay.
You know what? Yeah, look it up. Let's see what happens.
I'm going to look it up. But
there was Christopher Knight.
Yeah.
As Peter. I only know that because he was
Robert Reed.
There you go.
Okay, it was Robert Reed. Yeah. So.
Perfect. Okay.
But he was America's dad.
Yeah.
Everybody loved him. Right. So he's married to Carol Brady.
Right.
He can't be gay. You know, I mean, that's not, you know.
Florence Henderson.
Yeah, you can't be. People. Yeah, he couldn't be gay.
Oh, hell, he couldn't even sleep in the same bed as her. I mean, you know.
No, they did. They had a double bed.
They eventually did?
No, they had a double bed.
They pushed them together?
No, it was a real bed. So that was a little later. That was Lucy is what you're thinking of, with the twin beds.
Are you sure the Brady Bunch never slept in the...
I'm pretty sure they had. I could be wrong.
I don't know. Someone's screaming in their car. They're like, anyway.
Dude, I haven't watched that show in so long. I have no idea. So
yeah, it was my babysitter sometimes, Nick at Night.
I know. I mean, how do you think I got? And we've had this discussion, but how do you think I got so fascinated with Bob Crane? Because Hogan's Heroes was my babysitter every day. So you know, So yeah, it's I totally get it.
Gosh, and then somebody else is yelling. Will you just get back to the episode?
I know.
The night of the murder. Bob Crane. Okay, Wednesday, February 1st, 1922. Taylor spends the evening doing his taxes, going over some stuff. And so here's what we know. He gets a call. Nobody knows who it's from. He talks on the phone for a little bit. Mabel Norman stops by. They have some drinks. PV leaves at about 7:30. Mabel says she leaves around 8. At midnight, actress and neighbor Edna... Perviance? How do I...
Oh, I don't know. I'm looking at something about the Brady Bunch. Anyway, I'm sorry. Edna. Oh.
The neighbor.
Yeah. Perviance.
Perviance. Yeah. All right.
Sorry about that.
No, you're good. She notices all the lights are on at Taylor's, but she's like, nah, I probably shouldn't, you know, talk to him. It's too late. PB returns back to work at 7 a.m.
They slept in the same bed.
Son of a bitch.
You've probably heard this before. Carol and Mike Brady and the Brady Bunch are the first couple on television to share a bed. It's a common piece of trivia. It's completely wrong. The Bradys weren't the first couple to sleep together. They're not even in the first five. Married couples sleeping in separate beds were a common sight on television in the 50s. I Love Lucy, Father Knows Best, Dick Van Dyke, and many other shows featured married couples that were never in the same bed. Those beds always had the same setup, twin beds separated by a nightstand.
Yeah.
Reason for this is the Hayes Code.
We'll talk about it next episode. We have talked about it.
So the first show where people slept in the same bed, the Brady Bunch started in 1969. They shared a bed, but they were not the first ones.
But they did from the beginning? So I'm just misremembering
it. Yeah, the first couple to share a bed on television was 20 years earlier on Mary Kay and Johnny in 1947. But they were married in real life. Ozzie and Harriet also shared a bed. They were also married in real life. The first non-married couple to share a bed is disputed, but technically it should go to Fred and Ethel I Love Lucy. For the second season, Lucy and Ricky's lovable landlord share a bed in the episode First Stop when they take a road trip.
Wow.
Yeah.
Didn't we do some episode where somebody was
connected to Fred? Oh, and
you know
who else did? Fred and Wilma Flintstone. Oh, wow. Well, we talked about Fred himself.
He was related to
something? No, he was murdered and his ghost haunts the area of the theater. Yeah.
That's probably because he slept
Darren
in the same
bed. Darren and Samantha on Bewitched were the first couple. Most say it's Darren and Samantha, but Greenacres, the Munsters also predate the Brady Bunch.
You see Rob Zombie's redoing the Munsters?
I know. It's going to be awesome.
I'm really excited for
it's
that.
It's going to be awesome. Okay. I'm sorry. I am off the side trip. I don't even know how we got onto that. But
I love it.
Oh, Robert Reed. And then,
yes.
Poor Bob Reed, man. Okay. Anyway. All right. Let's move on.
Oh, boy. Okay. So I just went through the whole night of the murder. We're back.
Sorry. I didn't hear a word of it.
It's fine.
I already read it.
You wrote it. Yeah. Basically, Peavy returns back to work at 7 a.m., finds a body. Neighbors and people quickly contaminate the crime scene, as we've seen.
Everybody rushes in to look. Nobody calls the police.
Call everybody
as usual.
The police. Yeah. Paramount employees arrive, like you said, to remove anything that could damage the filmmaker's reputation. Notes, bootleg, liquor, whatever else they find.
We'll never know everything they ever found. I mean, we know about a couple of things. Somebody must have talked, but I'm sure there was other stuff.
There had to have
been. I like the fact that there was a note from Mary that was stuck as a bookmark in a book of erotic poetry. Yeah. And I'm thinking, Jesus, what else was in this house? You know, but yeah, that's one we know about. So
Paramount GM Charles Eaton, is that right? Arrives. Cops let him do pretty much whatever he wants. No question.
Works for the studio.
Yeah, just in and out. Not until the deputy coroner arrives do they realize, oh shit, this guy's been shot in the back.
Yeah. Which changes everything because they just thought he'd drop dead.
Right. Because of the way he landed in the chair.
He was laying on his back
stuff.
And it looked like he'd just fallen, which he had because someone shot him. But
yeah. Can somebody tell me if you get shot with a .38, is there just not a lot of blood? Is it not a big
Well, it
hole?
Must not have penetrated. It must not have gone all the way through. The bullet must have still been inside the
right,
body.
Right, but even
so,
from the back, though?
Well,
you would think.
I mean, I would think so, but maybe the way he landed.
Maybe the pressure or something.
You know, if it killed him instantly, mm-hmm. he wouldn't keep bleeding, right?
Well, sure,
because
yeah.
his heart would stop pumping. And I don't know exactly where he was hit. You just know it was in the back. So it could have severed, you know, a blood vessel or whatever, and it killed him instantly. But when he fell and was lying on his back, my guess is the pressure mm-hmm. from that kept it from bleeding too much, and it soaked maybe into the rug.
Right,
But didn't pool.
Okay, that's fair.
Because it didn't go all the way through. If it had gone all the way through, there'd been blood everywhere.
Right. So, all right, no, that's fair.
I mean, the last time I shot somebody in the back...
I was going to say...
No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, it was Jesse James. So Sands is a suspect. Peavy's a suspect. There's rumors of homosexuality, all the stuff.
Yeah, and then,
going.
And that's still, you know, hangs in there. And there's two things to blame for that. One, which we talked about before, that Hollywood Babylon book.
Oh, yeah.
Kenneth Anger's book is just full of just crap.
I thought you were going to pass out
garbage,
with how hard you just rolled your
lies.
Eyes.
I mean, it's just really badly skewed information. But the other thing is that he was trying to help this guy out. He, mm-hmm. you know, his African-American gay butler who had gotten in trouble because back then, of course, it was illegal to be gay. And he mm-hmm. must have gotten in trouble somewhere. Maybe he'd been someplace. And so Taylor was going to go to court and testify on his behalf to say, hey, listen, this is an upstanding guy.
Yeah.
You know, this was an anomaly. You know, he's a good dude. You know, and so just because he was trying to help this guy out. Oh, well, in a town where... as we've already, we literally just discussed, actors that were gay that were hidden away for decades mm-hmm. and decades, you know. But for some reason, people painted this as being, well, maybe that's why he was killed. Oh, he was killed because he was gay. Oh, come on, man.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't think that had anything to do with anything.
Sure.
So.
Okay. So, so that's all good to know then. A reporter named Floribel
Mir.
I love that name. It sounds like a, like Parks and Rec. Who's the guy that comes up with all those? It sounds like a name he would come up for one of the characters or something. Remained convinced that Peavy was a killer and tried to trick a confession out of him.
Yeah,
it was really fucking dumb. You heard it. It was dumb.
Yeah,
it was
dumb.
So dumb. A man seen leaving Taylor's house, but it was said he was just returning his car and got no answer at the door. No one's really helpful. No one's cooperative.
Yeah, because nobody saw anything.
Yeah, there's not a lot to go on.
And they don't want to, you know, his friends and his neighbors don't want to say anything bad. So, you know, I mean, this investigation was never, it was never going to go anywhere.
Never going to go
there
anywhere.
There were no real witnesses, and anybody who was a witness to anything wouldn't talk.
Right.
You know.
Mike Schur, that's his name. Anyway, if you guys love The Office, Parks and Rec, The Good Place, he did all of those. Anyway, so theories arise that Taylor and Mary are in a relationship like we talked about. She seems pretty open about, like, I had a huge crush on him, but it just
exactly,
wasn't
but
happening.
That's all it was. But, and then, the reporters put in this thing, oh, they found all her lingerie. Yeah, it was a
hanker.
Chef, and all that kind of stuff. It just, it's just.
But then she,
but she
full
did.
On kisses
she really,
his corpse.
She pursued him really hard.
Yeah,
and he was constantly going,
come
on now.
Hey,
you know,
good on him.
Yeah, you're way too young for me.
Yeah,
kind of thing.
Good for him. But she full on kisses his corpse at the funeral, makes
bad.
A big damn scene.
Yeah, and that's and
that kind
people
of
never forgot.
Nail
it.
In her coffin.
Never forgot it.
Chicago.
We'll talk about in an upcoming episode. We're going to talk about another actress that did the same thing at a funeral, well attended funeral, and it killed her career. Too.
Okay, all right.
Not with Taylor, but with a different character coming up soon.
Chicago Tribune said it's believed that movie interest
it's
would
a
spend
great quote,
a million not to catch the murderer to prevent the real truth from coming out. In years that passed, speculation included the idea that Taylor was murdered by a hired killer who was working for one of the drug dealers servicing Mabel Norman, like we talked about.
Yeah, I think that's most likely.
Yeah, I mean,
the most likely suspect there.
That's got to be. So. Anybody whose wallet's going to get light.
Oh, yeah. Well, and especially the kind of money they were making.
Yeah.
You know, selling coke and stuff to the Hollywood crowd at the time. I mean, you also have to remember, though, that it wasn't seen in the same way that it is today.
Well, was it still it in was, medicine and
no,
stuff then,
No, or? It wasn't by the 20s. Uh-huh. In the early 1900s, you could buy it in the drugstore. But by the 20s, it wasn't widely available. And it was kind of like, it was kind of a situation where we have marijuana distributed or, dispensaries in Illinois.
Yeah.
So you can go buy it legally, but you can't go buy it off the guy on the street.
Sure.
Where it would be cheaper.
So much cheaper.
So you could go to the grocery, you could go to the drugstore and buy it over the counter and get a small amount, but then you can buy an eight ball from the guy down the street.
Right.
So, you know, it's a little different. And that was kind of what was going on here, you know.
Were they cutting it with Arm & Hammer back then?
Yeah,
too,
I don't know. Or? Probably. Yeah.
Did I tell you?
The baby laxative.
I found a bag of weed outside my apartment a month ago.
No.
This is the third time in my life I've just found a bag of marijuana on the ground.
It seems sketchy and risky.
It does, yeah. And I haven't touched it yet.
Good.
But
that's good.
I'm
just in case.
I've been debating, but this happens to me. I just randomly find drugs.
Interesting.
Yeah. So weird stories. So DA Woolwine, who probably know more about the case than anyone else, resigned due to poor health. Dies soon after that case. Aza Keys, Woolwine's
we've
successor.
Talked about before.
When did we talk about her?
It's a he, and we've talked about
a he?
Him. Yeah, we talked about him a couple of times. Different
remember.
Cases that popped up.
All right. Well, vital evidence mysteriously vanishes. 1929, F.W. Richardson stated that he had positive info, but that he was unable to do anything due to the LAPD corruption.
Oh, you know when we talked about him? It was the Marion Parker stuff.
Oh, yeah. I want to come home tonight.
And Richardson, too, was the governor at the time.
Okay, I do remember Richardson.
Yeah.
And then 43, a man arrested on federal narcotics charges in Indiana claimed that he traded the killer's name for immunity. That did not
He might have known.
Why do you think that?
Well, because here's a guy on federal narcotic charges. So he probably had more information.
Oh.
So, I mean, going by the theory that I think that it was some of the drug guys that probably are the ones who killed him,
yeah.
This guy might have had real information, but nobody was going to give him immunity for it. So,
uh-huh. Okay.
You know, so.
I just thought it was a guy
trying
to cover
that. And by 1943,
who cares?
And it's in 20 years.
That's
I mean,
fair.
You know, is it really worth it?
I guess.
I don't know. So.
Oh, okay. Well. Let's see. I have a couple Patreon shout-outs I wanted to give. But first, I wanted to say, at this point, I have sent out the emails about your Patreon shirts because I do it on the 15th
every month.
Right. Please get back to me. And I want to I'm going to make some new stuff. I'm probably going to get some designer people to do some things. So
cool.
I've done it for pizza t-shirts and stuff.
Yeah.
But if anybody has any ideas of what you want to see with shirts, hey, I like this thing, this brand, this artist, whatever, let me know. But quick shout-outs to Pamela, Emily, Avi, I'm sorry, I don't know. And then Trident, which is just a dope name or a gum. I don't know. But thank you so much for supporting the show. Again, that's what makes it sound better as the listener review that we had earlier noted. And it is now time for our Ghostwriter segment. If you have a question or comment about the world of the macabre, you can email us at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. Just have one today. This one's from John. It's titled St. Louis Exorcism Priest Diary. It says, hey guys, just want to say I absolutely love your podcast. I've listened to every single episode in order on Spotify. This is all great information to know. I just think this is one of the best and most informative and fascinating podcasts like ever, let alone regarding true crime and the supernatural. Fantastic job. My favorite season was your Exorcist season, and my goodness, was it ever chilling. Can either of you tell me if there's any way, shape, or form to possibly obtain some legitimate copy of The Priest Diary or Little Black Book, as it was called, and I'm sure Troy has thoughts on this, in your authoritative and expert opinion and experience, do any such copies of the book or legitimate representations thereof, such as authentic excerpts, exist anywhere, either online or real life? Please let me know. And also, should no such representation exist, what would be your expert recommendation on where and what to read or watch that contains authentic firsthand/eyewitness accounts or recollections of that case? And that's a very well-worded email. Congrats on your hard work and success. This absolutely fabulous podcast. I appreciate and respect what you do. Let me know about the diary. Thanks. Troy, do you have thoughts on this?
Well, in a couple of weeks, the new edition of The Devil Came to St. Louis will be out, which is will be the only book that's come out that has all the information, including firsthand witness accounts. Mm-hmm. And it also has excerpts from the diary. And yeah, the diaries, I mean, I've got a copy. I mean, it used to be hard to get.
Really?
It's not hard anymore.
Interesting. Yeah. I thought it was like left in that, in the little, in the furniture and locked away.
Well, it was, but then when they got it out, when they opened up the room, it's everywhere now.
No shit.
Yeah, you can get it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, you can get it now. Well, it's out there.
John, it's out there. And if you want...
And if you can't, I mean, if for some reason you can't find it, email me.
Oh, sure.
And I can direct you to a copy.
Yeah, and John, I'll say if you want more commentary on it...
And then just hold on to the book.
Just get Troy's book.
It'll come out in a couple weeks, so...
That's awesome. Well, thanks for writing in. And AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com.
Yep. Sounds good.
Over to you, man.
All right. Well, guys, thanks so much for listening. I've been really enjoying the Hollywood season as it winds to a close. Cody's thinking, thank God, I've never seen any of these movies and don't know who these people are. Anyway, I'm kidding. But it's been a fun season. And as we get nearer to the end, we still have some good stuff coming. So don't wander off quite yet. And thanks again for everything. We hope to see you guys. Something coming up this fall. We've got tons of stuff coming up. And I'm actually doing, I think, probably more this year personally than I've done in quite a while. So it's going to be a fun year.
Did you get stir crazy? Got to get out of the house?
A little bit. A little bit. I just, we planned a lot more dinners and we've got some cool stuff coming up. And maybe by our next episode, I'll be able to announce what something new that we have coming up. So I will talk about that hopefully by our next episode. So.
Awesome. I don't have any clever thing. So this episode of the American Hauntings Podcast was written by Troy Taylor and the Brady Bunch and was produced and edited by me,
Brady Bunch.
Cody
Peck. Yeah, I should have.
If you're not a regular listener of the podcast, we hope you'll check it out at a bi-weekly dose of history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. You can find and subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or anywhere you listen to your favorite shows. Also, yeah, let me know where you guys listen to shows. If things are changing, apps are different now, what the kids are doing, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I don't know either.
I don't know.
Yeah, we've been talking about some different things, so I don't know. The next season may be different.
It's going to be exclusively on Pandora.
No, it'll be only available on our own app.
Yes.
No, it will not be. So.
Oh, yeah. So see the website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com for more info about the show, notes, photos,
understand
links,
and
more.
The subscribing to a single app for shows when they're all on iTunes. I don't understand.
If you don't have an iPhone, maybe?
Well, yeah, I guess. But, like, I mean, I don't... I hesitate to name a name of a company that makes a lot of podcasts, but why do I need their app that I need to pay for?
Oh.
You see what I'm saying? When they're going to put all the episodes on iTunes event. Well, you know, not always right away, though. So maybe it is.
Maybe a delayed thing.
I don't know. Well, anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you're
fine.
I don't know.
I was just wondering about
you're
that.
You're fine. So. Yeah. Yeah. If you're a regular, it seems like a terrible business model to me. If you're a regular listener, we hope you take the time to review us in the Apple Podcast app.
And I just realized you're not very. Friends. I'll shut up because this is never going to end. We got to change this thing, man. I'm
neighbors, relatives,
so
people you pass
boring.
In the street.
No one listens
to the Brady
to
Bunch,
this.
Whoever. We couldn't and wouldn't do the show without you. If you're a fan that you know that American Hauntings is not
just
this
podcast. I think
you
should just be happy I'm not playing
it's
Orson
books,
Welles
tours,
clips.
Events, and more on our main website is AmericanHauntings.net. I'm so happy there's no Orson Welles.
Yeah, see,
for those
I
who
you
who do write to us and tell us you wish we posted shows more often, or you can have fresh content if you support the show on Patreon. I'm going to have some stuff from the conference up there shortly. And some shirts if you guys email me back.
A lot of stuff.
That's not the only perk you
now
get
now you're interrupting
either.
Yourself.
I know.
It's so bad.
There
so.
Are discount shirts, stuff in the mail, all kinds of things. For those who don't understand how important our Patreon is to us, go back and listen to the first season. Don't tell me what you think about it, but just listen to that, listen to this one, and that's right. Yeah, Patreon's what made it all get better, so check it out at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings. If you have any comments about the show, suggestions, reviews, jokes, reviews of our jokes. What you want on a t-shirt, or just want to tell us what you really think of us, we're reachable via email, on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, messages in a bottle, carrier pigeon, and Telegram. Fuck.
Yeah,
until next time.
Goodbye.
So long.
Okay, bye.
See
enough.
You later.
Bye.
Oh, it's so long.
It is long. And that's shorter.
I know.
I cut it down.
I wonder if we're just, now that I take my headphones off, are we just yelling for 45 minutes at each other and then for other people in other rooms? Like, it seems so loud now. I know. There's no way.